systems change. Now, at the moment, I think it's fair to say that we are facing unprecedented changes in many different areas. And when I put an Instagram story out about how many bakers are facing serious challenges economically to their businesses, I had a huge response, predominantly in private messages. It's very interesting that the messages came in and not necessarily in the comments below. So I think some people are reluctant to admit that they are finding things difficult. On the other hand, there are some people who are holding their hands up and saying, actually, this is about as challenging as it's ever been. So I invited three amazing chaps who have been willing to discuss the current situation. It's Max and Henry and Josiah. So what I'm going to do first is I'm going to get each one of you to give a 1 minute introduction to yourselves, just to, for those people who are not familiar with you. And I should just, I'll call out in rotation, just so we kind of got an idea of the panelists. And then I've got some 1 minute quick fire questions to ask, and then we'll open up for discussion on costs of food, electricity or energy, and ingredients at the moment, and ideas of how we can mitigate these costs, because they are well, I'll let you talk about them. So first off, let me just ask, Max, can you give me a minute on your background, what you do? Think of it as being mastermind. Off you go.
Yeah.
Specialist subject now.
Okay. So my name is Max Abbott. I've got a sourdough bakery in the Cotswolds in Lechlade-on-Thames. It's the highest navigable point on the Thames. It's quite a busy little Cotswolds town. I kind of fell into baking 10 years ago now. I moved up from Cornwall, got a job in a restaurant, started making bread. We had a Michelin inspector in the kitchen, and he liked the bread and pointed at me and said, you should open a bakery. And that planted the seed for me 10 years ago. Then I took a small loan off my father-in-law and put a bakery in my garage, it's still in my garage. The business goal for us was to make a ton of bread a week, a ton of dough a week. And we're currently making about 2 tons. So we're way over what we originally planned for the business. But we're at a point now where we can't really physically make any more bread. So my focus has been more towards how can we do better. So up until sort of last year, we were purely using conventional flour. Still UK grain from within 50 miles of the bakery. We're really lucky where we are in the Cotswolds. We've got three really busy mills very close to us. And so we had a real, you know, a pick of the mill, as it were. But I've stuck with sort of conventional. And now we've got to a point where we're making 2 tons of bread a week, and we can't make any more. Like I said, it's like, how can we do better? So that's where I started talking to Vanessa a bit more, and trying to work out a way into talking to farmers.
Max, can I come back to you on that next? So if I introduce farmers, that would be a perfect point to introduce Henry. Henry, can you give me 1 minute on your background and what you're currently doing and you're leaning, and then we'll move over to Josiah.
I'm Henry Astor. I have a farm in the Northeast Cotswolds, not so far away from Max. It's traditionally been conventional. Over the last 15 years, we have, I guess the word would be regenerative, but we have been looking at ways in which we can produce food, but also increase biodiversity. And measuring that in a number of ways. In the last couple of years, we have gone down the path of growing some heritage grains, replacing conventional crops with heritage grains, introducing livestock and more diversity, like having a farm shop, and trying to really build the community so that people are connected with us as farmers and with the food that they eat, and in varying degrees of success and failure as I go on this journey. So,
cool. Thank you. That's fantastic. That's a good, good introduction. How many acres do you farm?
We farm 1,900 acres.
It's not a bad size.
Yeah, we've got about 250 acres of heritage grain in the ground, and heritage barleys, and we're trying to convert from that monocropping system into a more diverse system slowly.
Fantastic. Thank you, Henry. I'll come back to you on costs on food production and farming shortly. Josiah, can you give me 1 minute introducing yourself? Josiah is the founder of Hog My Dods. Over to you, Josiah.
Yeah, that's right. So co-founder of a business called Hog My Dod, and we act as a kind of an enabler, a facilitator between farmers and bakers and home cooks. We began about 13 years ago as an NGO project looking at what a more sustainable, resilient diet might be for Norwich and how we might need to change farming as a consequence of that. So always thinking about climate change, about resource constraints, and about the costs associated with all of those things. And we started with beans and peas and pulses, dried crops that are full of protein and do lots of good things in an agricultural rotation, and subsequently moved on to cereals and other seed crops that we can harvest to make this more diverse agroecological rotation.
Fantastic. Chaps, I think I'm going to try and just see if I can put you on all to see you all at once. I think I can. I don't know quite how I'm going to do that. Let me just see if I can put all of you at once. Hang on. If I do that, that means that we can all see each other at the same time. Is that going to make a difference there?
Can you see you all already? Is it?
Oh, I couldn't. Sorry, I could only see you in miniature. Right, chaps. Okay, so some quick fire questions just to kind of set the scene. The reason for this evening is costs and mitigating costs for bakers at the moment. And I would like to just do a quick round, one sentence at most, question to each of you. I'll use your names just to set the scene. So first question is, Max, have you seen a rise in costs of energy at the moment?
Yeah, that's significant. I've got my little bakery in the garage, but we also own a shop over the road that we sell sort of pizza and food and things like that from. Now, luckily, we've just signed a three-year contract six months ago at the bakery. Over at the shop, it's a different case, and our energy has tripled at the shop. So, the government said it's a 54% cap. That was a residential cap. Businesses, there was no cap on businesses. The price has gone sky high. We had a quote for the bakery, so obviously I'm interested in how much it's going to cost if these costs continue to stay as they are or rise. And our 2,000 averaging 2,000 a month electrical cost at the bakery is due to go up to about 6,000 a month.
Okay.
Which is insane. So like that's a real concern for somebody making, we do 2 tons of dough a week, and that cost is not really conducive with continuing to run a business selling wholesale bread. 90% of our business is wholesale bread. About 10% is direct sales through our shop. So
that's a serious tripling of your energy bill. Is actually, that's quite taking my breath away actually. So
yeah, it's huge, but it's not just electricity, it's diesel as well for doing the deliveries. That's almost doubled in the last 3 months. The costs are spiraling, but the electricity is a serious concern.
Okay, so I'm just going to move over to Henry. Max has immediately drawn the attention to diesel. Your farming, have you seen energy costs going up on your farm? And I'll come to fertilizer in a minute. I just want to just get a set the scene of what's going on with each part of this. Have you seen costs going up at your end yet?
Yeah, massively. I mean, red diesel, I think, has gone up from something like 53 pence a year ago to, I don't know what it is now, is it £1.20 or something? I mean, just to put that in perspective, last year it would cost me roughly £350 a day to run my combine harvester, and it would cost me probably £1,200-1,300 a day today to run my combine. So it's a massive factor. And and something I'm getting my head around, but maybe also burying my head in the sand as well a bit.
Okay, and coming back over to the cost of energy as well, you talked about sustainable farming practices, which I'll come back to defining that in a minute, just because I think that that's relevant to some of the conversation in lowering costs. Mm-hmm. On conventional farming, how many passes would you make on a tractor, and how much diesel would that actually, you know, take up? Because at this point, you're not quite tripling the cost of diesel as well. So we've got triple costs.
Yeah. So I think in a conventional system, most people could make 8 or 9. If you're Velcor, you might make 12. I don't know. But we started looking at this about 15 years ago, and of ways of reducing inputs, especially if they end in side, so, you know, insecticide, herbicide, and fungicide. And so with the heritage grain, it's absolute minimal inputs. There might be two or three passes.
I want to come back to the heritage grain as well, because that's something that, you know, might be relevant in terms of cost, because it used to be that heritage was really the not affordable option, and it's increasingly maybe looking a little bit more affordable maybe in comparison right now.
So with the conventional, probably 4 or 5 passes.
Okay.
I can't give you a number per liter per pass,
but you're getting two to three with heritage.
It depends. Some of our heritage is in a continuous cropping system, so actually, we'd have two.
Roughly.
You'd drill it and then you'd harvest it.
Don't worry, I'm not going to come count you. Seven men, we're looking 8 tonight. So okay, so there's something going on there with those. I'm just going to come over to Josiah. Josiah, your energy costs and costs at your end, what are you seeing in terms of your milling flour? Are you seeing similar issues around energy and cost of production with yourself?
Exactly the same. Our energy costs have tripled, and will continue to go up through the year. We know there'll be a review later on in the year and they'll go up again. So yeah, it does make a significant difference. We're quite fortunate in some respects in that the building that we're in is covered in solar panels, and that supplies a significant proportion of our energy. But on the other hand, the opportunity cost of supplying to us rather than supplying into the grid, because the value in has gone up. You know, it's quite a difficult calculation for our landlord. We don't own those solar panels. So potentially it may make, you know, it may not be such a huge benefit. And then elsewhere in the supply system that we're part of, there are other high energy uses. So drying grain, for example, at the end of the year, which if you're lucky and you can do that just with sort of passive means, but if you need to use any natural gas to create heat to blow through that grain, that's going to be quite expensive. And then moving things around, I mean, vehicle movements, whether it's pallets or bulkers, you know, 28 ton lorries, the fuel costs have gone up significantly, and that's sort of piled on top of what were already kind of pre-existing labor cost problems with finding people to drive those things around. And that can be either moving things from a farm to a place where they'll be cleaned and then sold, or in the other direction out to customers, and whether they're local or whether they're further afield, those costs have gone up really significantly.
Okay, so I'm going to come around to that question with all three of you now in terms of labour and labour costs. So quick fire question again, cost of living is going up exponentially. So two questions, have you had to increase your wages and what you're paying people, and is it difficult to find labour? So start with Max. Just a quick one on this, Max. I want to come around to some of the ideas.
Yeah, it's, I mean, cost of labour in the Cotswolds is high anyway, because it's everything costs more in these sort of high net worth areas, I suppose. But the cost of wages is going up. You know, the government tell us that we have to put the wages up every year anyway, the national insurance and things like that. But in an area like this, everything costs more. We're at our bakery, we're lucky. The bakery's in my garage, so we don't pay rent. That extra money goes to the staff.
And
finding staff.
How is finding staff in that
area? That's incredibly difficult. Certainly, with the situation with it, catering in general, a huge amount of European staff have gone back over to Europe, which has left a big hole in the pool of talent, as it were. And a lot of people just don't want to do baking hours aren't desirable. People don't want to do that.
No, that's true. Very true. Henry, are farming hours any more attractive?
No.
Okay. And are you? Gosh, you're all in the wrong job, boys. Come on.
Right. But do you know what? I love it. So that's why I get out of bed, and I'm a glass half full kind of person. But no, I mean, you know, I'd say we're all working probably 90 hours a week. You know, I mean, if I think about it, I get up at 5:30 and I'm out the door at 6:15 to feed my pigs and my chickens, and I'm, yeah.
So your pay, and in fact, is yourself. So can I ask a very personal question here? As these costs are going up, are you essentially earning less money as a person?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, right. Yeah. Just so
having said that, one of the things that I, and I'm sort of quite proud of, is I haven't been to a supermarket in 3 years. So I'm very fortunate that a lot of the food that we have on the farm, whether it's eggs, flour, venison, beef, you know, all of that, that we can use. So, you know, we have direct access to it.
We're all coming over to you for the next event, right? Fantastic. Josiah, labour costs and availability, how is that impacting your business at the moment?
It's not really, we haven't had to recruit anyone recently, so that's quite lucky. We gave everyone a fairly significant pay rise at the end of last year to accommodate the cost of living rise that had already happened. We will have to review that probably sooner than we might normally do, just in order that people are able to, you know, get by. And we don't live in an area as expensive as the Cotswolds, but in lots of respects, certainly in terms of housing and things, it's probably getting there, East Suffolk. You know, it's very fashionable. A lot of money through COVID coming out of London and sort of people relocating, and that pushed up both rental and, you know, house prices generally. So it's very difficult for people to live here. There's no public transport. Everyone has to have a car. You know, it's the typical rural problems, really, of, you know, employing people in a rural area. We're as you know, in a very rural location, so it's quite tricky.
Cool. And just final question on ingredients, and this is really an interesting conversation because this is the bit I've been dying to get to. The cost of ingredients themselves. Now, I know it's like you're stocking, I don't know how many in your range you stock, but is it close to several hundred or more now? Is that right?
In different variations often of the same thing. But yeah, I mean, the thing to bear in mind with this conversation is from last year's harvest.
We're still going from last year's harvest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this will hit us in, you know, really from mid-August on when we start buying crops.
Okay. What are you expecting to see from mid-August onwards, Josiah? What's coming?
I don't know.
No, seriously.
I really don't know. I mean, we work on a basis where we always have a conversation with the farmers we work with and ask them, you know, to be as, sometimes quite difficult to get them to be as kind of upfront as possible about the costs. So that we need to make sure, if we want to have a long-term relationship with a farmer, we need to be covering the cost of production and paying them a wage. There's no point in us paying them less than it costs them to grow the crop, because that's very short term. They're not going to grow for us in the next year. So we need to find ways of building relationships that work in the long term and that the return to farm works. So we'll need to have conversations with all those farmers about their costs and what that return needs to be for this year.
Okay, that leads me very beautifully up to Max. Max, you and I have been having conversations all week about some of the ideas that you've been putting in place, and your bakery situation. And I thought that part of today was your innovative approach. I was dying to share, really to spark other people's ideas in various areas. And we've got other conversations going on later next week with Adam Pagor on other kind of areas. But what you did, I was like, right, okay, come on. That has to be a main part of the conversation. And having Henry and Josiah here is brilliant. So can you just, on ingredients, can you give us A, how much you've seen an increase and so far with ingredients, B, what your kind of ideas are to mitigate that, and C, is why that is part of the, I like your sourdough revolution. Why is this a revolutionary approach from where you're standing?
Well, yeah, the cost of flour has kind of gone up. I think it's gone up 3 times in the last 3 months, really, because the local mill that we use mainly for our conventional flour, their costs go up. They've been swallowing as much as they can, but it's been so compounded in the last few months that those flour costs have just, you know, gradually been rising. What they're also doing is cutting out a lot of things from their range. Now, I am a little bit concerned about the cost of wheat, certainly moving up into September. I know the UK produces nearly all of the wheat that we need for our own needs, but we're still beholden to the sort of the fact that it's a commodity. It's like the price of wheat in the UK is guided by the cost of wheat across the rest of the world, really. One thing that I am doing is I'm buying a 20-foot container right now, and I'm gonna fill it with flour that should then hold. I should be able to get enough for the sort of next 6 to 9 months into the container, and that will hopefully mitigate some of the cost that I'm expecting to see with the new harvest in September.
So that's quite a serious piece of like kind of investment for you. So
yeah.
You've got a container, and I mean, I can't imagine going out and buying shopping for a container, but you know, it's bad enough trying to buy, you know, a small amount of flour. But yeah, so yeah, you've got your container. Are you having to rent it? Have you bought it outright? Are you sharing it with anyone? And is it in a as you popped it in the garden? What have you?
It's going to be on the other side of the property. Out the way of sort of just out the way, so it's not an eyesore. We'll probably clad it and that sort of thing. But it is that sort of £5,000 investment now is hopefully going to carry us through. I don't know how much wheat's going to cost in September. Is it going to be 600 a ton? What is it going to be? 700?
We already pay that, Max. So we already pay that to our farmers. So
yeah, fine. Yeah. So it's going to be more. It's going to be significantly more.
Yeah. I mean, we're paying 550 to 600.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, depending on where it's coming from and whether how clean it is. But yeah.
And so yeah, if I can get 20 or 15 tons maybe into that container, then that it's going to save me a little bit should the price go really high in September. But then, you know, no one's going to pay £10 for a loaf of bread, and so this is where we need to start working out actually what we're going to do as a business.
So potentially at this point in time, with the change in energy, the change in price of flour, the change in all these costs, you've worked out sort of forward planning that it could, if it keeps going, it could be as much as £10 a loaf at the current rate of increases.
But we'll never charge that.
No,
that's the sort of, you know, with the wage increases, electricity increases, that's what we should be charging.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's
insane. But then Pan Polan, when they came to the UK in the early 90s, were charging £12 for a loaf of bread in central London. And it, and everyone was like, how much? How dare you? But they did it and they carried on doing it. They set the bar very high. back then, but they're the only ones that managed to do that, I think.
Okay, so I'm going to come back to that subject because I want to talk about what we're defining as sourdough and the kind of breads that we're making. Because I was doing some calculations the other day on the boule versus the whole grain, how many we can fit in an oven. And then I was on the phone to Henrietta this morning, who's at Wakelands, working out how many we can get through the ovens at a time, and seeing about maximizing output for bakers.
We've been talking about it in the bakery, and actually currently we fit 12 freeform boules in a deck.
And
we get those through the oven in about 35 minutes. If I speak to Campbell nicely down at Rackmaster and get some longer strap tins made, we could fit 21 tins in an oven, so 21 kilos of dough instead of 12 kilos of dough. Cooking it at a lower temperature, so it will be in the oven for slightly longer, but there'll certainly be an energy saving there.
That's one way that can mitigate. The other question that we were talking about as well, and I want to come over to Henry on costs as well in terms of costs of flour, because one of the things that's very difficult is compromising on nutrition and using white flour. I wonder how, because I know some of your loaves have been kind of the traditional, very kind of beautiful boules. How did your customers, do you think that they would take a swap out and go for more wholemeal than the traditional white boule held up by a lot of sort of, you know, the white flour? Do you think that they would move over to that in terms of cost saving?
Henry,
to you.
Customers
would accept more whole grain in their.
I think the British, a lot of the British public like white bread. They really do. And so if we can squeeze in a bit more nutritional density without them really knowing about it, that's what we do. So, for us currently, all of our starter now is whole grain stone milled. So let's say I'm making 100 kilo batch. We're putting in 60 kilos of conventional, 20 kilos of sifted. So what would we call it? A high extraction white flour. And then another 20 kilos of stone ground. And then on top of that, there's 20 kilos of the stone ground whole grain starter going in. So we're trying to shoehorn the goodness into that loaf, but to keep the loaf as close to a white bread as we can, because that seems to be what our customers like. But then we've got a range. We have a range of bread. We do a pure wholemeal, and we do a granary loaf, all the free-formed loaves. Henry, a couple of weeks ago, we had a play with your flour from Bruern that held up much better in tins. That's part of the same conversation. It's like I think we touched on it at the farm, was that bakers now, if we want to be using the grains with higher nutritional benefits, we maybe need to be changing tack on how we're baking it and making it.
Okay, so that actually weirdly kind of fits in with stacking. It can get almost double in the oven in a tin. So I'm going to ask, I mean, from the point of view of, you know, maybe Josiah and Henry, I know, do you think that with the British wheats and the way that we grow and the way that we minimize our costs and maximize nutrition, do you think the tin loaf is now going to overtake the boule in terms of what will emerge from bakers having to look at their costs and energy, and also in terms of what people want from their bread? Do you think this is a big shift that is going to happen right now?
I think it's worth remembering that most loaves sold in the UK are tin loaves, but they're sold by supermarkets and they're made in factories. And it's only within the kind of artisanal sector that we have this tradition, which has been imported, of lovely, beautiful, round, kind of loaves that differentiate themselves by their shape as well as by their quality, and their, so visually they're very different. But I think the British public are very accepting of a tin loaf. It's a practical thing. You can put it in a toaster, you can, you know, you can make sandwiches and take them to work, that kind of thing. So I don't think there's any issue there with people's willingness to accept a tin loaf on principle. The question, I think, falls down to whether bakeries can add enough value to a tin loaf in order to retail it at the right price.
Yeah, that's, and I think the
experience is where that value added comes from.
So Josiah, before we move on from that, because I want to come back to Henry on costs and what he gets paid for his wheat from what on the farm, how would you define, you're right, because then instead of paying, bread isn't just bread, is it? I mean, it's a bit of a status symbol. I mean, I know this sounds really silly, Max, but Cotswolds, you know, I don't think that there could be a more kind of open place, I know, for the sourdough, you know, loaf being part of the local sort of life, that it's very, very sort of been very accepted very quickly, that kind of French, almost a French style sort of bread in many ways. What do we need to do to differentiate the tinned artisan loaf to make sure that we, cost-wise, that the consumers appreciate that this tin is not the same as an, because then you're literally, it's, you could say visually you were comparing two things that are the same. So can you give me some ideas about how bakers can, whilst keeping their costs in check, how they might be able to differentiate those loaves? Max, you as well, if you've got any ideas.
For me that's tricky, and that's why we've not moved over to tins just yet, because there is that perception from a lot of the general public that a tin loaf shouldn't cost, if a tin loaf is more than £2, people are getting a little bit sort of like head scratchy about it.
Okay.
And that's partly down to, you know, Hovis pumping out 9 million loaves a week and being able to make very, very small margins on each loaf.
Mm-hmm.
How would we bring the public round to that? I think it would be a slow process, really. I know that Richard Burtonet did have his tin loaf through Waitrose, potentially.
Well, I've been to the factory. It's a beautiful factory, and it's real sourdough, but it is not comparison to something that's just been freshly baked.
Yeah.
So let me come back to, I have an idea on that and I want to come back to it. But I just want to talk to Henry for a second and compare what's going on in terms of costs. Henry, we were talking, I can't remember who it was who was telling me earlier, and it was one of you was telling me that how much is conventional wheat? Was it 12? How much is it per kilogram? Is that 12 pence? Is that right? What are farmers being paid right now per kilogram of?
It depends what the wheat is. It depends what grade, you know, if it's animal feed.
No, I'm talking bread wheat here.
Bread wheat, yeah. I mean, it's, man, what are we up to now? I mean, 400, three.
So £400 a ton at the moment, is that right? So it's 40p a kilo, is that?
Yeah? It could be, yeah. As long as it's, I mean, it depends what the protein levels are and, you know, if it's a strong white or, but it could be as much as that. I don't know what, Josiah, what are you paying for?
So yeah, so I mean, to give that some context, last year feed wheat was 120, 150.
Yeah, 120, yeah.
Sorry, say that again, just so last year, what?
Last feed year, wheat? Feed wheat would have been 120 to 150, and
now it's 330.
Would have been 220 to 250, and now they've both basically doubled, easily doubled. And they're trading forwards at similar high prices. And that's very conventional. That's you know what you'd see in all the fields around you. Sort of standard model varieties on the recommended list. Whereas, you know, so we're paying significantly more than that, depending on what the grain is, as Henry said, what the quality of it is, where it's come from. So for the more complicated cereals that we may have to dehull, we pay significantly more for those. And for sort of standard milling wheats, we probably, last year we were playing probably between 450 and 550, and that's probably gone up by £100 for this year at the moment. And it we'll see what it looks like in September. We're in a very different place. You know, we're not, we're not selling flour at the scale that the millers in the Cotswolds are. So our customers are buying very particularly because of what it is that we're milling, rather than looking for their majority flour.
Okay, so we've got anything from, I mean, we're still not talking a huge amount here, even when you're paying 600, that's still only for a heritage, you know, one of your heritage, like some of the beautiful grains that you have at Homodods. They're very unusual, some of them. It's still not, you know, it's relative in terms of when you look at the yield from a heritage grain in comparison to the conventional, you've got a price there that is from sort of 300-400 to 600 at the moment. I don't know if that's comparing like with like, because the price of conventional's gone up.
One of the problems though is the price of wheat might go up, and it might, for a farmer's point of view, look really attractive. But people just won't buy it because they think it's too high, and they think it's going to come down. They think something the Ukraine's going to give, or they get. So sometimes you can be stuck looking at these great prices, but not being able to move it because speculators are speculating. And at the same time, the price of fertilizer is going up, and diesel, and, you know, living and all of that. So it's quite a complex kind of system that we're in. It is good that it's going up, but everything else is going up, and you might not be able to sell it as well. So we're kind of can be stuck in limbo, you know, as farmers.
So one of the things that I would be suggesting at the moment to the bakers that I teach, and I've been teaching a long time, is sometimes when you are in a position of change and having to make your tin loaf stand out, and you've got costs, one of the things that we tend to think of in many systems is very black and white, as in I'm all this or I'm all that. And one of the things that we're able to do in the best of all possible worlds, as Voltaire would say, is actually blend. So one of the techniques that I have had to use with bakers who faced difficulties over the years with costs, not always because of this kind of circumstance, is actually using some conventional wheat with a very special blend. And sometimes when you're using a conventional or you can still use local conventionally grown, sustainably grown, you know, like you've just said, Henry, that you are growing various grains in a more sustainable way, you can actually blend these amazing heritage at 20 or 30% with a slightly higher yielding, slightly lower cost. So something to bear in mind, for example, Max, if to differentiate those loaves, I would certainly be considering a sort of 40-60 blend at that point, to differentiate your loaf whilst not breaking the price barrier. And yeah, that would be one of the strategies I'd be looking at as a baker to make the best of all possible worlds. So you're therefore supporting both. You can support two systems in the same. You don't always have to be one or the other. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I think that's the way certainly that we're looking at going. As a guide, our conventional flour, when we get it from the mill, is around 60p a kilo. The regenerative stuff that we use in the stone ground is £2 a kilo. That is a significant price difference. So at the moment we're feeding in currently 30% actually per 100 kilo batch. And we're holding that line. We're each month breaking even, which is good. And again, my concern is the more of the heritage that we use, the cost goes up. But this is where I believe Henry comes in, because with the plans that he has, we're potentially going to be leveling that cost out a little bit, I believe. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you think about that, Henry.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's the idea.
You're on film, Henry.
That's the idea. But I should say also, about costs, because I had this really interesting, I was sitting down with the procurer, the food procurer of Oxfordshire, and we were talking about how we have a farm cluster here, how we can provide food to schools. And she kept saying, well, what about the cost? What about the cost? And I said, well, there's different costs. There's physical costs, there's mental costs, there's monetary costs. And so, not to be too picky, but if you're thinking about blending, it might lower the costs in the bakery, but what are the knock-on effects if you're blending with a conventional white that has, I don't know, whatever it's got in it? You know, are there health costs associated with that down the line? And in the larger picture, should those be included in when we're thinking about what are we baking and what are the overall costs and what are the knock-on effects of eating, you know, more wholemeal than pure white flour and all of that? And maybe it's too big a topic to discuss here, but it's something I certainly think about quite a lot.
For me, I think one of the things that's very difficult, and again, this is something to consider as a strategy that Max, you could think about as well, is it's actually very difficult to get people, and Max has just made a really good point, that people like their white bread. So one of the other strategies that you might be able to use, Max, which I think is quite fun, is we call it taking it from plip to big poop. Okay, so not to be too graphic about this, the white bread doesn't have any fiber in, so the plip is the plip, kind of like constipated, taking, you know, rabbit pellet plushes that you get because there's not enough fiber all the way through to the big poop breads that we celebrate here. In fact, we have double flushes, and if I'm really lucky, one of my kids will come out the bathroom and go triple flusher because they think this is fantastic. So one of the strategies that we have when we're teaching, and Max, you might want to take this from bullet to triple flusher, is actually doing a program where you could actually take your bread over a period of 12 weeks all the way up, or 10 weeks all the way up, from being white, and take it up 10% at a time each week. And rather than giving your customers a real slap saying, here's your whole meal, 100% big poop spread, go and chew on that, boys and girls, you could actually ask them to engage in a program where they re-educate their palate and their expectation of bread over a number of weeks. And I would be willing to bet that you could possibly engage quite a lot of your health conscious clients in moving over a number of weeks, 10% a week. And jokes aside, 10%, a 10% each increases each week. And you could almost do start programs where you can start and go back to the two percentages of whole grain within your tins. Brilliant. That you can say, well, I'll have a 20%, or I'll have a 40%, or I'll have a 60%, or I'll have a whole grain. And that is another really nice way of re-educating your customers without frightening them half to death.
Yeah.
I think that's a really nice way of doing it.
Another thing, I mean, which Henry just touched on, or you just touched on, Max, is that you shouldn't need to pay that much for really good quality regenerative flour or organic flour. And I'm sure Henry would be able to provide you with flour for probably not much more than a pound a kilo, or in that region. I don't want to speak for him, but but, you know, somewhere between a pound, maybe a pound, maybe I'll talk about to a pound 50, but it doesn't need to be £2, certainly. And if you're buying from a bigger miller, like the ones that you probably are buying, they ought to be able to do that for 80 or 90 pence, because they've got the economies of scale and the volume. So £2 does seem steep to me.
So I know that at the moment, Max is actually working quite closely with a local farmer, and he has been using flour from within a very close, you know, almost like a stone's throw, literally, haven't you, Max? That's been very successful in making it an extremely local product. And that's been quite successful.
Yeah, it has. Yeah, but that's my, actually the first person that I managed to do that with was Jeremy Clarkson up at his Diddley Squat Farm. He is growing conventional, but we're trying to work out if he can go to more of a regenerative method. Maybe. I'm not sure if you've spoken to him, Henry, at all yet.
Yes, come along, have a chat with him and let him know about regenerative farming. Yeah. Come on, Henry.
I think he's quite keen. I genuinely think that he is interested in looking after farming and seeing what he can do for the land.
I could be really terrible at this point, say he's got a lot to make up for. Sorry. Right, carry on.
I was just going to say, to Josiah's point, what's really interesting about the cost of keeping the cost down is if you're going from a conventional, so I have a conventional system, so I could get 3.5 to 4 tons an acre, okay? Mm-hmm. And right now I could sell that for, let's, I don't know, 500 quid, right? Or let's say feed wheat for 300. So it's almost £1,000 a ton. An acre. I'm getting £1,000 an acre, but there are some input costs involved in that. Heritage grain is a much less intensive system. So you might be getting, I'm always just looking for 1 ton an acre. Yeah. Sometimes I get 1.2. Some fields are crappy because we've got clay soil, 800, but roughly it's 1 ton. So you're in this transition, especially with high, you know, prices. It's quite, once you're transitioned, it's fine, but transitioning to a much smaller quantity, you've kind of got to keep the price up. You still got to pay for your tractors, you still got to pay for your combine, you still got to pay for your infrastructure. But yeah, I do think there is a point where the setup we have, so we're getting this mill, we've got a grain cleaner, gravity table, we've got this communal place where farmers can come and use our equipment to keep the cost down. And if we can get the volume, and that's what we're trying to do with this, we set up this Cotswold Grain Network after Grain Lab, basically to sort of link in with some of those other alliances. If we can go out and get the volume from people like Max, who say, we will commit to X amount, it doesn't matter how much it is, X amount a month, then we as farmers can plant it and we can use that communal equipment to keep the cost down and have that kind of surety that we can, and we're also isolated. It doesn't matter what's going on in Ukraine.
Can I just check then? Because I think I've just worked something out and I don't, and I'm worried that Max is going to slap me at this point. If Max or any baker for that fact were to come to you or I don't know if you can do this as well, Josiah, if they came to you and committed and said, I want 15 tons next year.
Yeah.
Would you be prepared to put the price on that, deal on it, so he wouldn't have, sorry, I'm going to get slapped, wouldn't be thinking I have to buy a unit and store the flour, because you could actually commit to that price and not have a baker think, okay, how do I mitigate these costs? So is that, am I correct in that? So
I do that. Oh, sorry, Josiah, go on.
Yeah, no, I was saying the same thing. We do that. That's a fairly standard thing to do.
Okay. So for any baker at the moment, so what sort of starting point?
With bakers.
So again.
I was just going to say, there are bakers. So I work with a couple of bakers who they wanted Malika. And I said, well, how much Malika do you think you want? And they said, I think it was 200 or 150 kg a month. Mm-hmm. And I said, fine, I'll put some Malika in and we'll try it. But you've got to commit to that. And so, yeah.
So my next question is, Henry, how do you mitigate the Hagberg falling number on that? So let's just say it's on the floor and it ferments as you look left at it. How would a baker like Max
would
go?
Would never be on the floor because my timing is always perfect.
And, I see. Yeah. Okay. So it's all about the timing, is it?
You know, if the worst comes to the worst, unfortunately, it goes to feed wheat for £330 a ton, and you know, we're all okay. But you know, I'll tell you what's really interesting is, without mentioning any names, there was a heritage grain that I grew, and I sent a sample to a mill and they rejected it. They said the protein's not high enough. That is a grain that I think I deliver about 300 kilos to a very trendy bakery that take it every month, 300 kilos of this stuff that was rejected from a mill. So to me, this is so important to be working with people who can look beyond, you know, this system that we have in place that is actually so fragile.
It's being measured by the wrong thing. It's being measured by a conventional system for the artisan bread movement. So that doesn't work. So before I go on and ask last questions, because I'm going to be opening up to conversations for question Q&A. Okay, so question to Henry and then to Josiah. Henry, what would be the minimum amount that you would consider committing to for a year from a baker who approached you directly?
Depends how far away they were.
Okay, so within your travel,
10 miles.
So well, not 10 miles. You know, I actually deliver to London too, and I think I deliver between 200 and 500 kilos a month to a bakery down there. Plus, I think I charge £60 delivery. So
what does that work out in terms of tons? So anybody who's making
half a ton between, you know, a third of a ton and half a ton.
Yeah.
I did a month there, but I mean, I would do 100. If Max said I want, you know,
I'm just giving the bakers who are listening on Instagram or on YouTube.
In 10 miles, if someone wanted 50 kilos, I'd do 50 kilos.
Okay. You know? And if they wanted a ton a year.
Just in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
So what's that? 100, that's 90. Yeah, so that's 80. What is that? Is that 80 kilos a month?
Yeah, 100 kilos a month. Yeah, so a micro bakery could still approach you in your area.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It's right. Yeah.
Josiah, same question for you. If you had a bakery approach you, what would be your sort of minimum commitment that you could facilitate?
So I think the first thing, coming back to what Henry was saying about making that commitment and Hackberg and protein, we wouldn't commit to anything until we'd actually seen the crop was in and harvested. We wouldn't want to sell. We're not futures speculators. We're not going to trade on something that hasn't actually been harvested. We'd want to know that harvest happened and the grain was of the right quality. So,
but you could hold it for people, couldn't you?
But we could hold it, and certainly we do that, particularly where we've got very small quantities of things, actually, interestingly, where we've only got a ton of something and someone says, well, I really want that and I want to use some of that through the year.
That is fantastic, because that brings me around to my next suggestion. Max, I hope you don't mind. I'm going to make another suggestion for your amazing new Cotswold tin loaves. If I was talking to Tim Spector about this last week on the webinar on nutrition and digestibility of bread. And one of the things that I was asked was, how do you choose a loaf? And my response was, I choose it. My first response was, I choose it a bit like my men, so hot, handsome, and something I want to take home with me. But on a slightly less risque answer, I'm very happily married, can I just say, for 25 years. So I'm just going to say, this is my sense of humour. Like wine. So one of the other things I would differentiate my tin with was I would swap it out each week. I would certainly ask for example, Henry, how many different types of grain do you grow on your farm? As in flavour-wise, well, how many could you put your finger on and go, this many?
I mean, I have a field of population of about 60 in one field of heritage grain. So it's quite a tricky, and I've got a barley field that's got about 40.
Barley.
But conventional, I see, like barley, oats, beans, wheat, what am I missing? Linseed.
Okay.
And sunflowers, actually, which is a big cash crop for me.
Well, that's a relief. They're in scarce supply, I think, coming. Josiah, roughly, and I do know roughly the answer to this because I've got almost all your flowers downstairs at the moment. How many different ones have you got at the moment that are homodods?
I don't know, probably 12 or 13.
Okay, so my differential again, Max, I would say if you need to get that tin loaf, the interest in the tin loaf, I would consider doing tasting notes. I'm very happy to lend you my beautiful tasting wheel. It took 3 years to design it. Yeah. But it's like a wine wheel. And actually engage your customers in a different flavour each week as well. Almost like, can you actually tell that, you know, have you got the palate that's sophisticated enough, like you would with a wine? And I think that those are tips and tricks and techniques that if you go back and have a look at, say, for example, I'm not saying that the bull is over, but with the rising price of energy, labor, and all of the rest of things, what do we talk about? Energy, labor, ingredients. I think there is a definite, maybe re-educational way that we can actually take. I mean, it sounds really horrible, but every time I've ever been given a slap in the face with my business, and I've had plenty, I've actually ended up learning something really cool. And although we can actually look at the cost of living as a crisis, I think bread and wheat is still one of the lowest cost ingredients to people. Good bread has got to be, for me, and for many people, they will go without other things but have really decent basics. I think that's important. But also becoming a little bit more sophisticated with flavour and taking the opportunity to really massively re-educate the palate and brains of our customers. I think that that has to be part of the, if we're going to lower the costs. I know I'm not going to ruin some of the stuff that Adam has talked about because he's got some very interesting ideas as well. But I think we'll go to Q&A now, but I would say that the most important thing and the most amazing things that Max has done is actually make those connections to the farmer and make that connection to committing to more flour, and to, you know, to mitigating the rising costs through actually sort of pre-booking his flour, really. I think,
yeah,
you know, hopefully there'll be lots of bakers who will take some of the inspiration from that approach.
One thing that we are doing as well, Vanessa, is that, like, on our delivery run, we do pass we do pass one of the mills, and mills are busy places. Certainly the bigger mills in the Cotswolds that we deal with, they're busy places, and I don't think they can have like lots and lots of customers turning up with vans at random times picking up like a pallet of flour.
Mm-hmm.
It needs additional planning, and it's taken me a while to get to that stage to have a conversation with the mill to say, look, can we save a bit of money if we're picking up on the way past? You know, I can understand they don't want lots of people running around industrial areas. But we, you know, that is one little saving that we can make.
And you're doing shared resources when it comes to not delivering with a half empty van.
Yeah, that's right. And just, okay, you know, it's saving their diesel. That's even if we're not getting a huge like cost discount, there's not as many particulates going in the atmosphere from the trucks that they've got to send around the Cotswolds to.
So you and Henry both said sharing resources with other people, sharing delivery costs, sharing equipment, and sharing. I'm going to have a look at the chat on here. I was going to say it's been very interesting. Just see if anyone has got any questions. So in Ireland, Chris has said they use potatoes as an inclusion after poor grain harvest. Okay, that's a nice idea. Chris is actually, what I'm going to say, was a potato farmer. He's now actually opening a sourdough school in Ireland. So rye, somebody said, yes, don't forget rye. Justifying a tin loaf, Ken said, emphasis on locally sourced ingredients. People like to support their regional economy. You also maintain a difference with others by using seasonal local ingredients. That's very, very true. Julia says, I'm in Lincolnshire. I bake botanical sourdough. Thank you. 75% white stone ground from the local mill. She's talking about sandwich loaves, about £4 each. So does anyone have any direct questions at the moment for, and feel very free to put your hand up, or you can put your microphone off and ask any questions to the chaps. I think as we go to Q&A, oops, hang on. I'll just say for Instagram purposes and for YouTube purposes, I'll say thank you very much, chaps, and then for sharing all those thoughts at the moment, setting a scene of what is incredibly difficult at the moment. Just to summarise some of the things that you have said that are quite sobering. Max, you made the point that your costs have tripled with power. You've made the point as well, Henry, that your red diesel has gone from 53 pence last year to 120 pence at the moment this year. We've all had costs go up in terms of labour in the past year, and we've been looking at pretty much every which way we look. There's been triple costs on pretty much everything. The very interesting thing I was looking at in terms of listening to the approach to flour is the reduction in energy from your sustainable agricultural practices of having two passes of the tractors against three to four, two for heritage, three to four for sustainable, and up to 9 to 12 for the conventional high yielding. So just on that alone, it's really worth bakers actually, you know, looking for that, you know, that that space where they can support sustainable food practices, growing practices to support their farmers. And last of all, direct relationships with the farmers is going to really seriously help even quite small bakeries if they make that connection to the farmer to, to help the farmer to know how much he's getting, and to help the baker to know how much the cost is. So actually making that connection to the farmer, even as a small baker, is going to make a real difference to being able to plan where your costs are going. And that's quite important. So I'm going to round that up and say thank you to all three of you. And then if anyone's got any questions, the floor is open. Anybody got any questions today? Okay.
Just answered everything.
Have we? I don't know if I've got any questions. If Ken's usually quite vocal. Okay, I have a question. Max, would you share your oven with someone?
Sorry, would I?
Yes, as in...
Yeah, I would actually. You know what? There's a guy in town that's just... he's doing a sort of a little pie venture, and I have offered my oven space and mixers to him in the daytime, outside of baking times.
Okay.
Yeah, I would do that.
What time do you close in the evening?
The pizza shop.
The bakery.
We run the bakery from... I'll be in the bakery at 3 o'clock tomorrow morning, and we're normally cleaned down and out by 1 p.m.
So you could almost do a bakery share for some lunatic who wanted to work a night shift.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, yeah, so that's another kind of...
There's options.
Okay. Other questions in terms of cost saving to Josiah. Can you see any cost savings that the bakers can make while supporting British farmers? Is there anything that can be combined, or anything that you can think of in terms of costs?
Well, obviously, energy use is going to be the biggest change that most bakers are going to see. I mean, I'm always interested to really understand what percentage of a finished loaf retail price the flour actually is, and how much of the loaf, because we don't bake, so I don't really know anything about that. But how much of it is labour costs and rent and business rates and that kind of thing? You know, where how the loaf how the pie of the loaf, as it were, divides up, and where, what goes where, and whether flour is, you know, the difference between paying 60 pence and 90 pence, you know, how much difference does that really make to a finished loaf? That's a rhetorical question. I don't really know.
Someone done that analysis?
Well, so as an example, let's, if we combine the conventional with regen and 60p and £2, so £1.30 a kilo for the flour. Let's, okay, Josiah, we'll go with your costs, like lowball it a bit more. So let's say it's £1 for the regen stone ground and 60p. So that would bring it down to 80 pence a kilo, 80 pence a loaf for the flour that's going into a 1 kilo loaf, let's say. And we're retailing that at £5, wholesaling at 380. So there's a significant cost in the stuff, in making the bread, in retarding the loaf. This is something we touched on, Vanessa, before as well. It's like this method of proving and then retarding the loaf. Maybe to save costs, we should be thinking about not retarding the loaf and doing an ambient. Going back to more of an ambient loaf.
That's a really good point.
Because we can still get very good bread if we're using a really well fermented starter in a higher percentage. We're still getting that the benefits of the really well fermented grain.
The French were doing ambient bread for my entire. That's how I learned. French that didn't have a fridge. The fridge had a bit of moldy cheese in it. And that was it.
Yeah, that's it.
So,
the cost is significant. £4.20 is the cost of labour, electricity, delivery. It's significant. That's for if we're retail. That's that if we're retailing it.
So your cost by the time you've put everything on top of it, so your rent, your insurance, your labour, your electricity, all of your costs, your profit on your loaf is only actually what about 80p?
The business doesn't really turn over profit. It all feeds back into the staff, to be honest with you. But that we own our building, so we've been very lucky in that. That's part of the thing with staffing, you know, we have to be able to offer, you know, a decent wage to the people that work for us, and we need to be able to limit the amount of hours that they're doing, the amount of early mornings that they're doing, and to pay people more means, you know, we don't quite make as much, but you know, it's a lifestyle for me. All three of my kids have grown up with me working from home.
So I'm going to ask another question here. I actually know the answer to this. So Josiah, how many hours do you put into this, and from your own personal cost to doing what you do?
All the hours.
All the hours.
So yeah. we're you're talking 60 hours plus a week, you and Nick.
I don't like to count them.
We know it's true. I know the hours you work. Henry, you talked about 90 hours a week. Max, I don't want to even think about it, but come on, Max, how many hours roughly?
Well, actually, no, I'm trying to make sure my guys don't do more than 40 hours a week, to be honest, Vanessa.
I was talking about you.
Yeah, me. Well, I live here, so the bakery is at home.
Roughly how many hours? Are you exceeding 40 hours a week?
I don't try to, but I'm looking after, you know, I look after the kids a lot. I've always got my eye in the bakery.
Okay.
My hand on the dough.
So I would say that most people are putting in a lot more hours than, you know, and are a lot of what I see at the moment with the bakers is they're having to put more and more in.
Yeah.
To keep everything afloat, more hours, more resources, and same with farmers and you know, just
yeah, that's true. As well. Yeah.
So gentlemen, thank you very, very much for coming on and discussing everything where the situation we're in at the moment. I would like to think that we can do something. I spoke to you guys earlier about doing something more regularly and having a forum where we can share these kind of things more often. I'm going to put this on Instagram. I might have to split it in two. So thank you for coming. I don't think any of our audience have any questions. So thank you for
Ken loving. Ken has had some questions actually.
Sorry, Ken. Carry on.
So he says, can the various grain alliances expand their role to get groups of regional stakeholders involved from farm to oven? I think that's actually happening, Ken, certainly with our group in East Anglia. So I'm sure that's happening elsewhere as well. Could this even allow the smallest micro bakeries to join in the give and take of the baking economy? Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's happening. Yeah, I think totally.
I think it's very, what I saw from UK Grain Lab and actually then coming back and starting the Cotswold Grain Network to do just that. I don't see why, you know, people can't do it. It is happening, you know, and actually I wonder if these small groups all got together, it's one large kind of movement that share sort of common goals and common, you know, vision to have that farm to oven.
So
structure.
Following on, Ken, from the Grain Lab 2 or 3 years ago, I immediately came back and built something we call the Milling Hub. And it's global. It's across every country because I was saying earlier, we have students in almost 80 countries around the world. And on that Milling Hub are all of the direct contact details of all of the farmers that will supply a grain in many days. We have, I think, over 200 plus, maybe 300 entries in there. So I will share that link on this, on the post, wherever I put this out on stories. And I'll also make sure that, I know Homer Dodds are on there already because I put them on. So Henry, I will make sure that your details are on there, and I will, Max, I'll send that over to you in stories as well, and you can share that out so people can make those connections back to the farmer. And I think we'll talk more about the bread making process and supplying consumers on Wednesday. We've got seasonal Adam Pagor on more techniques in the bakery as well that will maybe help mitigate some of these rising costs, and let's hope that things get better. So thank you, chaps. Good night.
Thanks, Vanessa.
Thanks, Vanessa.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
See you all.
Bye.
Thanks. Good night.
Good night. Thanks, Max.